Jeanne Flavelle's Hot Commodity Podcast Series. Empowering clients with commercial intelligence, supply chain expertise, and risk management solutions.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kevin Combs, Vice President here at McKinney Flavelle. Today is Friday, January 24, 2020, and welcome to our Hot Commodity Podcast. Today, I have in our hot seat our very own Nicole Thomas. Welcome, Nicole.
Hey, Kevin. How's it going?
It's going well out here in somewhat sunny California. So,
well, I was guessing that it had to be at least warmer there than it is here. It's ridiculous here. By my standards. By my 10 years in California standards.
Not so much. Well, we get to brag about weather a lot, and today's no different. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, Nicole, we got a lot on the mind today, apparently. You had a lot of topics we're going to talk about, and you want to talk about a long-term outlook on commodities. So give us some ideas of what you want to tell us today.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm preparing for those inevitable client questions surrounding, well, what's your three-year outlook? You know, while you're at it, why don't you throw a five-year outlook out there for us? So, you know, it's easy for us to get caught up in the day-to-day gyrations of markets. And, you know, that's mostly because the decisions we have to make often tend to be shorter term in nature. But it's kind of like driving, right? You know, you want to keep your eyes on the car right in front of you. But if you can look ahead down that road a bit, you may be able to see the taillights coming on and know to start braking now rather than having to make a hard and jarring stop later on. So today I want to talk about the big picture, sort of the long-term picture for a few markets, including corn and soybeans, as well as a couple of edible oils, soybean oil and palm oil, as well as sugar. And, you know, maybe later we'll go into, you know, some greater detail on a broader list of commodity markets on a longer IQ post soon to cover some of these. But for now, let's kind of skim the surface a bit, if you don't mind. What do you think?
No, that sounds great. Lots of stuff to cover, and interested to get your take on a couple of these for sure, because I hear the same type of questions you are. So let's get started. What do you think out there of corn? Seems like there's a lot of talk right now about, you know, what, how many acres are going to get planted? What will the March 31 planting intentions report tell us, et cetera?
Yeah. And see, and that is an example of us kind of looking at that car in front of us. So, you know, I think one thing to kind of consider with the longer term is that today, the major producers of South America and the Ukraine together make up roughly 60% of the global corn trade. And that's up from about 35% just 10 years ago. And of all the major exporters globally, arguably the most important to watch and the one really shaping how the market will function is Brazil, both in the short term, as in what might happen with those planted acres in the U.S., but also, you know, 3 and 5 years out. You know, you look at the country of Brazil, its corn exports are 5 times higher now than 10 years ago.
Wow.
And production still has room to grow. I know. Amazing, right?
Right.
In fact, CONAB is suggesting that Brazil can produce 3 crops per year, which would keep that country in the export market all year long. So, right. And you know, and all that corn won't be for export. They continue to ramp up beef and poultry production domestically, much of which will ultimately be destined for the export market, sure, and even some corn-based ethanol production. So impact on U.S. will likely be greater competition from both sort of the corn itself, as well as the value-added ag products, as well as potentially additional competition for ethanol exports down the road. But its potential impact on the market, I think, is really changing, or potentially changing, the traditional price cycle for futures, particularly if that country can improve its infrastructure and logistics.
You mentioned, you know, corn and 3 crops and potential competition on the export markets for corn, also from the ethanol. When you look at their yields, their agricultural practices, et cetera, how competitive do you see that making it? And does it change the futures market now, where we see corn going, you know, from 350 to, say, 450 a bushel?
You know, that's a good question. And they still have room to grow in terms of yield. And of course, you know, some of those farming practices have evolved quite a bit over the last 10 years as well. And I think sort of the thing to keep in mind longer term is what influence, to your point, what influence will that kind of constant corn production have on the price when it's all said and done? And, you know, thus far, even with, you know, what they have in place now, they've been pretty effective in increasing corn production year on year. You know, they have their weather issues just like we do.
Of course.
But as far as the pricing of all of this is concerned, I think that does lead to us lending or staying towards the lower end of range or prices. And you know what? I'll reveal that little nugget for our IQ and Premier customers at the end. How about that?
All right. I awesome. Dig that. How about soy? Obviously, Brazil's been going gangbusters with soy over the past many years. So what do we see there?
Well, you know, soybeans, it's a similar story. When it comes to beans, Brazil has been very impactful there as well. Today, Brazil alone accounts for about half of the global exports of soybeans and about 30% of global production. So they're nearly neck and neck with the U.S. And considering the sharp decline in U.S. soy production in 2019-20, Brazil is projected to produce somewhere around 26 million metric tons more of soybeans than the U.S. This year. So just as Brazil will likely be an increasingly significant driver of corn prices, soybean market dynamics will probably closely reflect what's happening in Brazil in the coming 3 to 5 years, particularly when it comes to China. And that's one that, of course, in the U.S. market, we're very curious about and will continue to be vigilant about as it relates to that trade agreement, sort of phase one deal, waiting on more details there to see how that's really spelled out and what that will ultimately lead to as far as U.S. export demand. But with the Chinese sort of suggesting that ultimately prices and competitiveness is going to be a factor in what those numbers are, then you can see where longer term Brazil will still be very competitive with us in that space.
Okay. What about anything from Argentina you think that's going to change long term, or they're going to continue to just slowly ramp up as well?
I think they'll continue to slowly ramp up. And they've done the same thing over the last 10 years that Brazil has done. They're just using more of that internally. So in terms of the export market, not quite as impactful to what's available for import as Brazil is. With Argentina, it's kind of interesting because they seem to sort of swing on a pendulum from the, you know, sort of fiscal side of things or from one extreme to the other that I think is a little more of a hindering component for them having the same sort of influence in the market that that Brazil does. But I do believe that ultimately they will continue to increase production, definitely increase more crushing domestically there as well, and continue to be, you know, the one component of the big three when it comes to the soybean market on a global scale.
Yeah, I think one question we get on all these commodity markets, we're talking a lot about supply and production. And what about on the demand side for these products? Do we think there's going to be increasing demand, and you know, how strong would that be on a global basis?
You know, a very good question. And I think that also plays into the edible oils piece of this, and specifically soybean oil. So we've seen meal demand grow tremendously in the last 10 years or so as well. We're not immune to hiccups in the sense of, you know, what seems to be every year some new viral issue that's impacting global livestock numbers that subsequently impacts protein demand. But I think longer term, one thing that a lot of people will keep a close eye on is this whole sort of emerging market, still pretty small at this point, admittedly, but this emerging market of sort of meat alternatives and vegetable-based proteins, both in the sense of what impact that could have on sort of the growth or maybe slowing the growth of meal consumption that we've seen in the last few years, but also as it relates to using some of those products or products derived from some of those same sort of underlying feedstock for some of these other markets, and if that drives a little bit of growth there, and how that could impact not just production but ultimately pricing for those products. So there's a lot to look forward to, I guess, in the next few years.
No, definitely. All right. Anything else on the edible oil side?
You know what? Yes. Let's talk a little bit more about the oil side. Now, I think for the next few years, edible oils, the markets there will continue to show this almost month-to-month sort of seesaw of volatility. And that dynamic is attributed to just the month-to-month variability in both supply and areas of demand that drive growth, as well as the close price relationship between the various oils. And we see that with soy and palm oil, where factors driving one often very handedly influence the other. Production-wise, the expectation is that soybean acreage and oil palm hectareage will continue to grow, driven by some of that meat protein consumption we were just talking about, and that soy oil production accordingly should continue to trend higher as well. Now, two things to consider longer term, though. One is how this trend of vegetable-based meat substitutes pans out. Now, I guess personally, I'm not expecting that to be huge in the next couple of years, but maybe 5 years down the road, we're having some different conversations. And that could also be more of a regional factor with certain markets seeing more of the growth in sort of just traditional meat proteins, where other markets are seeing at least a segment or a share of that demand being met by some of these meat substitutes. Now, the other factor is related to consumption. Of those oils. And I think along with more traditional influence of food use, what sort of makes a difference between, you know, 30, 31 cents per pound FOB prices for soybean oil and, you know, 35, 36 cents per pound prices for soybean oil is biodiesel. And although consumption for that category should continue to grow, it may be at a lower rate than the prior 3 years. You got fuel efficiency improvements for diesel fueled vehicles. And, you know, that will take some increased mandated consumption to sort of drive that growth via things like higher blend rates. And many folks would argue that's the main factor behind growth, especially in an environment of relatively tame petroleum-derived energy prices. And another sort of political factor of consumption in the coming years being these policies geared towards restricting feedstock use for biodiesel production. And we're seeing that happen right now in Europe when it comes to palm oil. And this question of whether expanding production of some of these oil-producing crops is truly effective in tackling sort of that purported purpose of reducing emissions, that whole discussion probably isn't going away anytime soon. So those would be a couple of things I would look at if I were trying to view this from a 3 to 5 year outlook for the edible oils.
All right, great. And then last and certainly not least, because it's one of my favorite topics, definitely one of my favorite topics, we want to talk a little bit about sugar. So I think you said, let's start a little bit with the future side. What are you right. thinking as far as number 11 raw and number 16 domestic futures?
Good question. So for the number 11, I would state that everyone at McKinney Flavelle has been of the opinion that prices should have been a little higher than what we were seeing in the last 6 to 12 months. But, you know, really, I think it's more important to kind of look at whether we're going to see that $15 or $16 per hundredweight sugar for this year. but also thinking about, well, what's out there on the horizon as we move down the road. And longer term, I think there are two, maybe three factors to consider. First, on the supply side, a developing one is the GM-free sugarcane. Brazil has already tested and begun implementing it on a small scale. Other countries may move forward with it in years to come. And this could, you know, arguably change the supply side of the balance sheet over the course of the next 3 to 5 years, especially if utilizing GM sugarcane has a substantive impact on the cost of production. And the yield improvements mimic those we've seen with like beet sugar in the U.S. over the last 7 years or so.
Yeah, that was definitely a huge benefit for the sugar beet farmers here in the United States. So.
Could exactly.
Definitely alter the landscape a little bit. Right.
Right. And I think that dynamic also segues into the second factor, which is one for demand. Now, a lot of the push for this GM sugarcane has been to supply the ethanol industry in countries where most of the major feedstock for that production is sugar. And it could ultimately, I don't know, maybe create a sort of two-tiered sugar market with the GMO-based cane destined for ethanol production and the non-GM cane destined for edible consumption. And that's only if the GM-free trend, you know, really emerges on a global scale. And I think there a case could be made that we're not quite there. And in that sense, the influence of GM sugarcane could also lead to a more consistently lower 11 market if we were to see that really take off on a broader scale. I think right now we're still very much in its infancy. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that we're going to see that anytime soon, but certainly something to be considered further out into the future. And lastly, I think it gets forgotten often in terms of influence on the number 11 is that a currency. Arguably, one reason why, 11 sugar prices have, or a component into why those prices have stayed relatively weak over the recent memory. And at times, the correlation to strength or lack thereof in the Brazilian real in sugar prices has been notable. So not to say that's always the case, but at times, the correlation is certainly very strong. And accordingly, looking at the Brazilian economy and potential growth in the next few years, could that have significant influence or a significant influence on the number 11? And at times, might that be, either contrary to core fundamental dynamics and indications for the market or, sort of supplementing that or accentuating some of those moves? I think it's something to keep an eye on for longer term effects on number 11.
Right.
Now, for the 16 and domestic commercial prices for refined sugar, it's all about the sugar program. Barring those situations of occasional yet significant production or supply disruptions, I think overall prices stay relatively stable. Obviously, that's not the scenario we're in right now because we have some major supply disruptions. But when we aren't facing those types of situations, that sugar program effectively creates a floor for pricing in the low 30s per pound. So really the variability comes with from the ceiling, which is tied to either issues in domestic supply and or Mexican supply of sugar and to a lesser degree production elsewhere in the world. And demand is relatively flat. So in years of great production, perhaps there's a little softness to that floor. But as it relates to a 3-year or sort of a longer term outlook, I guess it's effectively maintaining the status quo, excluding any major production issues like we're seeing this year.
All right. Well, a lot of people are out there, our audience, don't necessarily pay attention to the futures markets for sugar. What about sugar prices? Do you see anything different there or kind of continuing on as the sugar program is likely to remain in place, et cetera?
The sugar program, I think, becomes the leading and the most important factor as far as pricing is concerned. And to a great degree depending on sort of which side of it you stand on, can make the argument that the point of it is to sort of maintain some consistency in pricing and not have as much of that volatility from season to season, again, barring some, or unforeseeable major issue that impacts the market and that more than likely coming from the supply side. So in that sense, you know, kind of where we've been trading prior to this year, I think is more for the norm and what we can expect, again, excluding some sort of issue on the supply side. And, you know, with some of our plus and premier folks here in this next segment here, we'll talk a little bit about what that price range looks like. I don't think it'll be too surprising to anybody, but just a little motivation to get with McKinney Flavel.
Awesome. Great. Thanks for that excellent long-term outlook on the grains, oil seeds, and sugar. Now, before we sign off, I'd like to everyone know about our spring seminar, Food X.0, The Revolution Has Begun. We've certainly seen a lot with plant-based proteins, et cetera, starting to change the thought process for consumers and manufacturers alike. And we'll be covering a lot of these topics, and as well as our traditional topics, at our seminar on April 29th in Chicago area. And hopefully we see you all there.
Be there or be square.
Be there or be square. Okay. I'm not sure what square means in that case.
I'm showing my age.
I'm kind of round, so I'd like to be a little more square, I think. But
you didn't watch Pulp Fiction. Come on.
No, I don't remember that line. But
oh, goodness.
So everyone, thank you for joining us. And that wraps up our weekly Hot Commodity Podcast. Want to thank everyone for listening in. And as Mike always says, live with an attitude and gratitude. Until next time. Take good care.
See you later.
That concludes this podcast episode. For expanded commentary and more detailed information, log on to McKinney Flavel's IQ Ingredient Intelligence platform and listen to our Market Insights podcast. If you're not a subscriber, visit McKinney-Flavel.com for more information. And as always, follow us on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter.